worse, although she finally did get a secretarial job. She had good skills and she was very pretty. Did you know that? Hodges makes a non-committal noise. If he were to reply honestly, he might have said, I can believe it because I see it in you. One time she agreed to take me to a concert. It was you two, and I was mad to see them. Ollie liked them too, but the night of the show she started vomiting. It was so bad that my parents ended up taking her to the ER and I had to stay home watching TV instead of pogoing and screaming for Bono. Ollie swore it was food poisoning, but we all ate the same meal and no one else got sick. Stress is what it was. Pure stress. And you talk about hypochondria. With my sister, every headache was a brain tumor, and every pimple was skin cancer. Once she got pink eye and spent a week convinced she was going blind. Her periods were horroramas. She took to her bed until they were over. And still kept her job. Janie's reply is as dry as Death Valley. Ollie's periods always used to last exactly 48 hours, and they always came on the weekends. It was amazing. Oh, Hodges can think of nothing else to say. Janie spins the letter around a few times on the coffee table with the tip of her finger, then raises those light blue eyes to Hodges. He uses a phrase in here, something about having nervous tics. Did you notice that? Yes. Hodges has noticed a great many things about this letter, mostly how it is in many ways a negative image of the one he received. My sister had her share, too. You may have noticed some of them. Hodges pulls his tie first one way, then the other. Janie grins. Yes, that's one of them. There were many others. Patting light switches to make sure they were off. Unplugging the toaster after breakfast. She always said bread and butter before she went out somewhere, because supposedly if you did that, you'd remember anything you'd forgotten. I remember one day she had to drive me to school because I missed the bus. Mom and Dad had already gone to work. We got halfway there, then she became convinced the oven was on. We had to turn around and go back and check it. Nothing else would do. It was off, of course. I didn't make it to school until second period and got hit with my first and only detention. I was furious. I was often furious with her, but I loved her too. Mom, Dad, we all did, like it was hardwired. But man, was she ever a sack of bricks.
Too nervous to go out, but she not only married, she married money.
Actually, she married a prematurely balding clerk in the investment company where she worked, Kent Trelawney. A nerd, I use the word affectionately. Kent was absolutely okay, with a love of video games. He started to invest in some of the companies that made them, and those investments paid off. My mother said he had the magic touch, and my father said he was dumb lucky, but it was neither of those things. He knew the field, that's all. And what he didn't know, he made it his business to learn. When they got married near the end of the 70s, they were only wealthy. Then Kent discovered Microsoft.
She throws her head back and belts out a hearty laugh, startling him.
Sorry, she says, just thinking about the pure American irony of it. I was pretty, also well-adjusted and gregarious. If I'd ever been in a beauty contest, which I call meat shows for men, if you want to know, and probably you don't, I would have won Miss Congeniality in a walk. Lots of girlfriends, lots of boyfriends, lots of phone calls, and lots of dates. I was in charge of freshman orientation during my senior year at Catholic high school and did a great job, if I do say so myself. Soothed a lot of nerves. My sister was just as pretty, but she was the neurotic one, the obsessive-compulsive one. If she'd ever been in a beauty contest, she would have thrown up all over her bathing suit. Janie laughs some more. Another tear trickles down her cheek as she does. She wipes it away with the heel of her hand. So here's the irony. Miss Congeniality got stuck with the coke-snorting dingbat, and Miss Nervy caught the good guy, the money-making never-cheat husband. Do you get it?
Yeah, Hodges says. I do.
Olivia Wharton and Kent Trelawney. A courtship with about as much chance of success as a 6 months preemie. Kent kept asking her out, and she kept saying no. Finally, she agreed to have dinner with him just to make him stop bothering her, she said. And when they got to the restaurant, she froze. Couldn't get out of the car, shaking like a leaf. Some guys would have given up right there, but not Kent. He took her to McDonald's and got value meals at the drive-thru window. They ate in the parking lot. I guess they did that a lot. She'd go to the movies with him, but always had to sit on the aisle. She said sitting on the inside made her short of breath.
A lady with all the bells and whistles.
My mother and father tried for years to get her to see a shrink. Where they failed, Kent succeeded. The shrink put her on pills and she got better. She had one of her patented anxiety attacks on her wedding day. I was the one who held her veil while she vomited in the church bathroom, but she got through it. Janie smiles wistfully and adds, "She was a beautiful bride."
Hodges sits silently, fascinated by this glimpse of Olivia Trelawney before she became Our Lady of Boatneck Tops.
After she married, we drifted apart, as sisters sometimes do. We saw each other half a dozen times a year until our father died, even less after that.
Thanksgiving, Christmas, and the 4th of July?
Pretty much. I could see some of her old shit coming back, and after Kent died, it was a heart attack. All of it came back. She lost a ton of weight. She went back to the awful clothes she wore in high school and when she was working in the office. Some of this I saw when I came back to visit her and Mom, some when we talked on Skype.
He nods his understanding. I've got a friend who keeps trying to hook me up with that.
She regards him with a smile. You're old school, aren't you? I mean, really? Her smile fades. The last time I saw Ollie was May of last year, not long after the city center thing. Janie hesitates, then gives it its proper name. The massacre. She was in terrible shape. She said the cops were hounding her. Was that true?
No, but she thought we were. It's true we questioned her repeatedly because she continued to insist she took her key and locked the Mercedes. That was a problem for us because the car wasn't broken into and it wasn't hot-wired. Well, we finally decided... Hodges stops, thinking of the fat family psychologist who comes on every weekday at 4, the one who specializes in breaking through the wall of denial.
You finally decided what?
That she couldn't bear to face the truth. Does that sound like the sister you grew up with?
Yes. Janie points to the letter. Do you suppose she finally told the truth to this guy? On Debbie's blue umbrella? Do you think that's why she took Mom's pills?
There's no way to be sure, but Hodges thinks it's likely.
She quit her antidepressants. Janie is looking out at the lake again. She denied it when I asked her, but I knew. She never liked them, said they made her feel woolly-headed. She took them for Kent, and once Kent was dead, she took them for our mother. But after City Center, she shakes her head, takes a deep breath. Have I told you enough about her mental state, Bill? Because there's plenty more if you want it.
I think I get the picture.
She shakes her head in dull wonder. It's as if the guy knew her.
Hodges doesn't say what seems obvious to him, mostly because he has his own letter for comparison. He did. Somehow, he did. You said she was obsessive-compulsive to the point where she turned around and went back to check if the oven was on.
Yes.
Does it seem likely to you that a woman like that would have forgotten her key in the ignition?
Janie doesn't answer for a long time. Then she says, actually, no.
It doesn't to Hodges either. There's a first time for everything, of course, but did he and Pete ever discuss that aspect of the matter? He's not sure, but thinks maybe they did. Only they hadn't known the depths of Mrs. T's mental problems, had they? He asks, ever try going on this blue umbrella site yourself, using the username he gave her? She stares at him gobsmacked.
It never even crossed my mind, and if it had, I would have been too scared of what I might find. I guess that's why you're the detective and I'm the client. Will you try that?
I don't know what I'll try. I need to think about it, and I need to consult a guy who knows more about computers than I do.
Make sure you note down his fee, she says.
Hodges says he will, thinking that at least Jerome Robinson will get some good out of this, no matter how the cards fall. Why shouldn't he? 8 people died at City Center, and 3 more were permanently crippled, but Jerome still has to go to college. Hodges remembers an old saying, even on the darkest day, the sun shines on some dog's ass.
What's next?
Hodges takes the letter and stands up. Next, I take this to the nearest U-copy, then I return the original to you.
No need of that. I'll scan it into the computer and print you one. Hand it over.
Really? You can do that?
Her eyes are still red from crying, but the glance she gives him is nonetheless merry. It's a good thing you have a computer expert on call, she says. I'll be right back. In the meantime, have another cookie.
Hodges has three.
10.
When she returns with his copy of the letter, he folds it into his inner jacket pocket. The original should go into a safe, if there's one here.
There's one at the Sugar Heights house. Will that do?
It probably would, but Hodges doesn't care for the idea. Too many prospective buyers tromping in and out, which is probably stupid, but there it is. Do you have a safe deposit box?
No, but I could rent one. I use Bank of America just 2 blocks over.
I'd like that better, Hodges says, going to the door.
Thank you for doing this,
she says, and holds out both of her hands, as if he has asked her to dance.
You don't know what a relief it is.
He takes the offered hands, squeezes them lightly, then lets go, although he would have been happy to hold them longer. Two other things. First, your mother. How often do you visit her?
Every other day or so. Sometimes I take her food from the Iranian restaurant she and Ollie liked. The Sunny Acres kitchen staff is happy to warm it up, and sometimes I bring her a DVD or two. She likes the oldies, like with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I always bring her something, and she's always happy to see me. On her good days, she does see me. On her bad ones, she's apt to call me Olivia, or Charlotte, that's my aunt. I also have an uncle.
The next time she has a good day, you ought to call me so I can go see her.
All right, I'll go with you. What's the other thing?
This lawyer you mentioned, Schron, did he strike you as competent?
Sharpest knife in the drawer, that was my impression.
If I do find something out, maybe even put a name on the guy, we're going to need someone like that. We'll go see him. We'll turn over the letters.
Letters? I only found the one.
Hodges thinks, ah, shit, then regroups. The letter and the copy, I mean.
Oh, right.
If I find the guy, it's the job of the police to arrest him and charge him. Schron's job is to make sure we don't get arrested for going off the reservation and investigating on our own.
That would be criminal law, isn't it? I'm not sure he does that kind.
Probably not, but if he's good, he'll know somebody who does. Someone who's just as good as he is. Are we agreed on that? We have to be. I'm willing to poke around, but if this turns into police business, we let the police take over.
I'm fine with that, Janey says.
And she stands on tiptoe, puts her hands on the shoulders of his too tight coat, and plants a kiss on his cheek.
I think you're a good guy, Bill. And the right guy for this.
He feels that kiss all the way down in the elevator. A lovely little warm spot. He's glad he took pains about shaving before leaving the house. 11. The silver rain falls without end, but the young couple, lovers, friends, are safe and dry under the blue umbrella that belongs to someone, likely a fictional someone, named Debbie. This time, Hodges notices that it's the boy who appears to be speaking, and the girl's eyes are slightly widened, as if in surprise. Maybe he's just proposed to her. Jerome pops this romantic thought like a balloon. Looks like a porn site, doesn't it? Now, what would a young pre-Ivy Leaguer like yourself know about porn sites? They are seated side by side in Hodges' study, looking at the Blue Umbrella startup page. Odell, Jerome's Irish setter, is lying on his back behind them, rear leg splayed, tongue hanging from one side of his mouth, staring at the ceiling with a look of good-humored contemplation. Jerome brought him on a leash, but only because that's the law inside the city limits. Odell knows enough to stay out of the street and is about as harmless to passers-by as a dog can be.
I know what you know and what everybody with a computer knows, Jerome says. In his khaki slacks and button-down Ivy League shirt, his hair a close-cropped cap of curls, he looks to Hodges like a young Barack Obama, only taller. Jerome is 6'5",
and around him is the faint, pleasantly nostalgic aroma of Old Spice aftershave. Porn sites are thicker than flies on roadkill. You surf the net, you can't help bumping into them. And the ones with the innocent-sounding names are the ones most apt to be loaded. Loaded how? With the kinds of images that can get you arrested. Kiddie porn, you mean. Or torture porn. 99% of the whips and chains stuff is fake. The other 1%, Jerome shrugs. And you know this how. Jerome gives him a look, straight, frank, and open. Not an act, just the way he is, and what Hodges likes most about the kid. His mother and father are the same way, even his little sis. Mr. Hodges, everybody knows, if they're under 30, that is. Back in the day, people used to say, don't trust anyone over 30. Jerome smiles. I trust them, but when it comes to computers, an awful lot of them are clueless. They beat up their machines and expect them to work. They open bareback email attachments. They go to websites like this, and all at once their computer goes HAL 9000 and starts downloading pictures of teenage escorts or terrorist videos that show people getting their heads chopped off. It was on the tip of Hodges' tongue to ask who HAL 9000 is. It sounds like a gangbanger tag to him, but the thing about terrorist videos diverts him. That actually happens? It's been known to. And then, Jerome makes a fist and raps his knuckles against the top of his head. Knock, knock, knock. Homeland Security at your door. He unrolls his fist so he can point a finger at the couple under the blue umbrella. On the other hand, this might be just what it claims to be. A chat site where shy people can be electronic pen pals. You know, a lonely hearts deal. Lots of people out there looking for love, dude. Let's see. He reaches for the mouse, but Hodges grabs his wrist. Jerome looks at him inquiringly. Don't see on my computer, Hodges says. See on yours. If you'd ask me to bring my laptop, do it tonight, that'll be fine. And if you happen to unleash a virus that swallows your cruncher whole, I'll stand you the price of a new one. Jerome shoots him a look of condescending amusement. Mr. Hodges, I've got the best virus detection and prevention program money can buy, and the second best backing it up. Any bug trying to creep into my machines gets swatted pronto. It might not be there to eat, Hodges says. He's thinking about Mrs. T's sister saying, it's as if the guy knew her. It might be there to watch. Jerome doesn't look worried. He looks excited. How did you get onto this site, Mr. Hodges? Are you coming out of retirement? Are you, like, on the case? Hodges has never missed Pete Huntley so bitterly as he does at that moment. A tennis partner to volley with, only with theories and suppositions instead of fuzzy green balls. He has no doubt Jerome could fulfill that function. He has a good mind and a demonstrated talent for making all the right deductive leaps. But he's also a year from voting age, 4 from being able to buy a legal drink, and this could be dangerous. Just peek into the site for me, Hodges says. But before you do, hunt around on the net, see what you can find out about it. What I want to know most of all is, if it has an actual history, Jerome cuts in, once more demonstrating that admirable deductive ability. What do you call it? Backstory. You want to make sure it's not a straw man set up for you alone. You know, Hodges says, you should quit doing chores for me and get a job with one of those computer doctor companies. You could probably make a lot more dough, which reminds me, you need to give me a price for this job. Jerome is offended, but not by the offer of a fee. Those companies are for geeks with bad social skills. He reaches behind him and scratches Odell's dark red fur. Odell thumps his tail appreciatively, although he would probably prefer a steak sandwich. In fact, there's one bunch that drives around in VW Beetles. You can't get much geekier than that. Discount Electronics, you know them? Sure, Hodges says, thinking of the advertising circular he got along with his poison pen letter. They must have liked the idea because they have the same deal, only they call it the Cyber Patrol, and their VWs are green instead of black. Plus, they're mucho independents. Look online, you can find 200 right here in the city. I thinks I stick to Cho's, Massa Hodges. Jerome clicks away from under Debbie's blue umbrella and back to Hodges' screensaver, which happens to be a picture of Allie, back when she was 5 and still thought her old man was God. But since you're worried, I'll take precautions.
I've got an old iMac in my closet with nothing on it but Atari Arcade and a few other moldy oldies. I'll use that one to check out the site.
Good idea.
Anything else I can do for you today?
Hodges starts to say no, but Mrs. T's stolen Mercedes is still bugging him. There's something very wrong there. He felt it then and feels it more strongly now. So strongly, he almost sees it. But almost never won a Cupid doll at the county fair. The wrongness is a ball he wants to hit and have someone hit back to him. You could listen to a story, he says. In his mind, he's already making up a piece of fiction that will touch on all the salient points. Who knows? Maybe Jerome's fresh eye will spot something he himself has missed. Unlikely, but not impossible. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure.
Then clip Odell on his leash. We'll walk down to Big Licks. I've got my face fixed for a strawberry cone.
Maybe we'll see the Mr. Tasty truck before we get there, Jerome says. That guy's been in the neighborhood all week, and he's got some awesome goodies.
So much the better, Hodges says, getting up. Let's go.
12. They walk down the hill to the little shopping center at the intersection of Harper Road and Hanover Street with Odell padding between them on the slack leash. They can see the buildings of downtown 2 miles distant, city center, and the Midwest culture and arts complex dominating the cluster of skyscrapers. The Mac is not one of I.M. Pei's finer creations, in Hodges' opinion. Not that his opinion has ever been solicited on the matter.
So what's the story, Morning Glory? Jerome asks.
Well, Hodges says, let's say there's this guy with a long-term lady friend who lives downtown. He himself lives in Parsonville. This is a municipality just beyond Sugar Heights, not as luxe, but far from shabby.
Some of my friends call Parsonville Whiteyville, Jerome says. I heard my father say it once, and my mother told him to shut up with the racist talk.
Uh-huh. Jerome's friends, the black ones, probably call Sugar Heights Whiteyville, too, which makes Hodges think he's doing okay so far. Odell has stopped to check out Mrs. Melbourne's flowers. Jerome pulls him away before he can leave a doggy memo there. So anyway, Hodges resumes. The long-term lady friend has a condo apartment in the Branson Park area. Wyland Avenue, Branson Street, Lake Avenue, that part of town.
Also nice.
Yeah. He goes to see her 3 or 4 times a week. 1 or 2 nights a week he takes her to dinner or a movie and stays over. When he does that, he parks his car, a nice one, a Beamer, on the street, because it's a good area, well-policed, plenty of those high-intensity arc sodiums. Also, the parking's free from 7 p.m. to 8 a.m.
I had a Beamer. I'd put it in one of the garages down there and never mind the free parking, Jerome says and tugs the leash again.
Stop it, Odell. Nice dogs don't eat out of the gutter.
Odell looks over his shoulder and rolls an eye as if to say, you don't know what nice dogs do.
Well, rich people have some funny ideas about economy, Hodges says, thinking of Mrs. T's explanation for doing the same thing.
If you say so. They have almost reached the shopping center. On the way down the hill, they've heard the jingling tune of the ice cream truck, once quite close, but it fades again as the Mr. Tasty guy heads for the housing developments north of Harper Road.
So one Thursday night, this guy goes to visit his lady as usual. He parks as usual, all kinds of empty spaces down there once the business day is over, and locks up his car as usual. He and his lady take a walk to a nearby restaurant, have a nice meal, then walk back. His car's right there. He sees it before they go in. He spends the night with his lady, and when he leaves the building in the morning,
his Beamer's gone bye-bye.
They are now standing outside the ice cream shop.
There's a bicycle rack nearby. Jerome fastens Odell's leash to it. The dog lies down and puts his muzzle on one paw.
No, Hodges says. It's there. He is thinking that this is a damned good variation on what actually happened. He almost believes it himself. But it's facing the other way, because it's parked on the other side of the street.
Jerome raises his eyebrows.
Yeah, I know. Weird, right? So the guy goes across to it. Car looks okay. It's locked up tight just the way he left it. It's just in a new place.
So the first thing he does is check for his key, and yep, it's still in his pocket. So what the hell happened, Jerome?
I don't know, Mr. H. It's like a Sherlock Holmes story, isn't it? A real three-pipe problem.
There's a little smile on Jerome's face that Hodges can't quite parse and isn't sure he likes. It's a knowing smile. Hodges digs his wallet out of his Levi's. The suit was good, but it's a relief to be back in jeans and an Indian's pullover again. He selects a five and hands it to Jerome. Go get our ice cream cones. I'll dog-sit Odell.
You don't need to do that. He's fine.
I'm sure he is, but standing in line will give you time to consider my little problem. Think of yourself as Sherlock. Maybe that'll help.
Okay, Tyrone, feel good delight pops out. Only you is Sherlock. I is Dr. Watson.
13. There's a pocket park on the far side of Hanover. They cross at the walk light, grab a bench, and watch a bunch of shaggy-haired middle school boys dare life and limb in the sunken concrete skateboarding area. Odell divides his time between watching the boys and the ice cream cones.
You ever try that? Hodges asks, nodding at the daredevils.
No, sir, Jerome gives him a wide-eyed stare. I is black. I spends my spare time shooting hoops and running on the cinder track at the high school. Us black fellas is mighty fast, as the whole world knows.
Thought I told you to leave Tyrone at home.
Hodges uses his finger to swap some ice cream off his cone and extends the dripping finger to Odell, who cleans it with alacrity.
Sometimes that boy just show up,
Jerome declares. Then Tyrone is gone, just like that. There's no guy and no lady friend and no Beamer. You're talking about the Mercedes killer.
So much for fiction.
Say I am.
Are you investigating that on your own, Mr. Hodges?
Hodges thinks this over very carefully, then repeats himself. Say I am.
Does the Debbie's Blue Umbrella site have something to do with it?
Say it does.
A boy falls off his skateboard and stands up with road rash on both knees. One of his friends buzzes over, jeering. Road rash boy slides a hand across one oozing knee, flings a spray of red droplets at jeering boy, then rolls away shouting, AIDS! AIDS! Jeering boy rolls after him, only now he's laughing boy.
Barbarians, Jerome mutters.
He bends to scratch Odell behind the ears, then straightens up.
If you want to talk about it.
Embarrassed, Hodges says. I don't think at this point.
I understand, Jerome says. But I did think about your problem while I was in line, and I've got a question.
Yes?
Your make-believe Beamer guy. Where was his spare key?
Hodges sits very still, thinking how very quick this kid is. Then he sees a line of pink ice cream trickling down the side of his waffle cone and licks it off. Let's say he claims he never had one.
Like the woman who owned the Mercedes did.
Yes, exactly like that.
Remember me telling you how my mom got pissed at my dad for calling Parsonville Whiteyville?
Yeah.
Want to hear about a time when my dad got pissed at my mom? The only time I ever heard him say that's just like a woman?
If it bears on my little problem, shoot.
Mom's got a Chevy Malibu, candy apple red. You've seen it in the driveway.
Sure.
He bought it new 3 years ago and gave it to her for her birthday, provoking massive squeals of delight.
Yes, Hodges thinks Tyrone Feelgood has definitely taken a hike.
She drives it for a year. No problems. Then it's time to re-register. Dad said he'd do it for her on his way home from work. He goes out to get the paperwork, then comes back in from the driveway, holding up a key. He's not mad, but he's irritated. He tells her that if she leaves her spare key in the car, someone could find it and drive her car away. She asks where it was. He says in a plastic Ziploc bag along with her registration, her insurance card, and the owner's manual, which she had never opened. Still had the paper band around it that says, "Thanks for buying your new car at Lake Chevrolet." Another drip is trickling down Hodges' ice cream. This time he doesn't notice it even when it reaches his hand and pools there.
In the...
glove compartment, yes. My dad said it was careless. And my mom said...
Jerome leans forward, his brown eyes fixed on Hodges' gray ones.
She said she didn't even know it was there. That's when he said it was just like a woman, which didn't make her happy.
Bet it didn't. In Hodge's brain, all sorts of gears are engaging.
Dad says, honey, all you have to do is forget once and leave your car unlocked. Some crack addict comes along, sees the buttons up, and decides to toss it in case there's anything worth stealing. He checks the glove compartment for money, sees the key in the plastic bag, and away he goes to find out who wants to buy a low-mileage Malibu for cash.
What did your mother say to that?
Jerome grins. First thing, she turned it around. No one does that any better than my mom's. She says, you bought the car, and you brought it home. You should have told me. I'm eating my breakfast while they're having this little discussion and thought of saying, if you'd ever checked the owner's manual, Mom, maybe just to see what all those cute little lights on the dashboard signify, but I kept my mouth shut. My mom and dad don't get into it often, but when they do, a wise person steers clear. Even the Barbster knows that, and she's only 9.
It occurs to Hodges that when he and Corrine were married, this is something Allison also knew.
The other thing she said was that she never forgets to lock her car, which so far as I know is true. Anyway, that key is now hanging on one of the hooks in our kitchen, safe, sound, and ready to go if the primary ever gets lost.
Hodges sits looking at the skateboarders but not seeing them. He's thinking that Jerome's mom had a point when she said her husband should have either presented her with the spare key or at least told her about it. You don't just assume people will do an inventory and find things by themselves. But Olivia Trelawney's case was different. She bought her own car and should have known. Only the salesman had probably overloaded her with info about her expensive new purchase. They had a way of doing that. When to change the oil, how to use the cruise control, how to use the GPS. Don't forget to put your spare key in a safe place. Here's how you plug in your cell phone. Here's the number to call roadside assistance if you need it. Click the headlight switch all the way to the left to engage the twilight function. Hodges could remember buying his first new car and letting the guy's post-sales tutorial wash over him. Yep. Right. Gotcha. Just anxious to get his new purchase out on the road to dig the rattle-free ride and inhale that incomparable new car smell, which to the buyer is the aroma of money well spent. But Mrs. T was obsessive-compulsive. He could believe she'd overlooked the spare key and left it in the glove compartment. But if she had taken her primary key that Thursday night, wouldn't she also have locked the car doors? She said she did, had maintained that to the very end. And really, think about it.
Mr. Hodges.
With the new smart keys, it's a simple 3-step process, isn't it? He says. Step 1, turn off the engine. Step 2, remove the key from the ignition. If your mind's on something else and you forget step 2, there's a chime to remind you. Step 3, close the door and push the button stamped with the padlock icon. Why would you forget that with the key right there in your hand? Theft-proofing for dummies.
True dat, Mr. H., but some dummies forget anyway.
Hodges is too lost in thought for reticence. She was no dummy. Nervous and twitchy, but not stupid. If she took her key, I almost have to believe she locked her car. And the car wasn't broken into. So even if she did leave the spare in her glove compartment, how did the guy get to it?
So it's a locked car mystery instead of a locked room. This be a foul pipe problem.
Hodges doesn't reply. He's going over it and over it. That the spare might have been in the glove compartment now seems obvious, but did either he or Pete ever raise the possibility? He's pretty sure they didn't. Because they thought like men? Or because they were pissed at Mrs. T's carelessness and wanted to blame her? And she was to blame, wasn't she? Not if she really did lock her car, he thinks.
Mr. Hodges, what does that Blue Umbrella website have to do with the Mercedes killer?
Hodges comes back out of his own head. He's been in deep, and it's a pretty long trudge. I don't want to talk about that just now, Jerome.
But maybe I can help.
Has he ever seen Jerome this excited? Maybe once when the debate team he captained his sophomore year won the citywide championship. Find out about that website and you will be helping, Hodges says.
You don't want to tell me because I'm a kid. That's it, isn't it?
It is part of the reason, but Hodges has no intention of saying so. And as it happens, there's something else. It's more complicated than that. I'm not a cop anymore. And investigating the city center thing skates right up to the edge of what's legal. If I find anything out and don't tell my old partner, who's now the lead on the Mercedes killer case, I'll be over the edge. You have a bright future ahead of you, including just about any college or university you decide to favor with your presence. What would I say to your mother and father if you got dragged into an investigation of my actions, maybe as an accomplice?
Jerome sits quietly digesting this. Then he gives the end of his cone to Odell, who accepts it eagerly. I get it.
Do you?
Yeah.
Jerome stands up and Hodges does the same. Still friends?
Sure. But if you think I can help you, promise me that you'll ask. You know what they say, two heads are better than one.
That's a deal. They start back up the hill. At first, Odell walks between them as before, then starts to pull ahead because Hodges is slowing down. He's also losing his breath. I've got to drop some weight, he tells Jerome. You know what? I tore the seat out of a perfectly good pair of pants the other day.
You could probably stand to lose 10, Jerome says diplomatically.
Double that and you'd be a lot closer.
Want to stop and rest a minute?
No. Hodges sounds childish even to himself. He means it about the weight, though. When he gets back to the house, every damn snack in the cupboards and the fridge is going into the trash. Then he thinks, make it the garbage disposal. Too easy to weaken and fish stuff out of the trash. Jerome, it would be best if you kept my little investigation to yourself. Can I trust your discretion?
Jerome replies without hesitation. Absolutely. Mum's the word.
Good.
A block ahead, the Mr. Tasty truck jingles its way across Harper Road and heads down Vinson Lane. Jerome tips a wave. Hodges can't see if the ice cream man waves back.
Now we see him, Hodges said.
Jerome turns, gives him a grin. Ice cream man's like a cop.
Huh?
Never around when you need him. 14. Brady rolls along, obeying the speed limit, 20 miles per here on Vinson Lane, hardly hearing the jingle and clang of Buffalo Gals from the speakers above him. He's wearing a sweater beneath his white Mr. Tasty jacket, because the load behind him is cold. Like my mind, he thinks. Only ice cream is just cold. My mind is also analytical. It's a machine. A Mac loaded with gigs to the Googleplex. He turns it to what he has just seen. The fat ex-cop walking up Harper Road Hill with Jerome Robinson and the Irish setter with the nigger name. Jerome gave him a wave, and Brady gave it right back, because that's the way you blend in. Like listening to Freddie Linklater's endless rants about how tough it was to be a gay woman in a straight world. Kermit, William, I wish I was young, Hodges, and Jerome, I wish I was white, Robinson. What was the odd couple talking about? That's something Brady Hartsfield would like to know. Maybe he'll find out if the cop takes the bait and strikes up a conversation on Debbie's blue umbrella. It certainly worked with the rich bitch. Once she started talking, nothing could stop her. The debt ret and his darky houseboy. Also Odell. Don't forget Odell. Jerome and his little sister love that dog. It would really break them up if something happened to it. Probably nothing will. But maybe he'll research some more poisons on the net when he gets home tonight. Such thoughts are always flitting through Brady's mind. They are the bats in his belfry. This morning at DE, as he was inventorying another load of cheap-ass DVDs, why more are coming in at the same time they're trying to dump stock is a mystery that will never be solved. It occurred to him that he could use his suicide vest to assassinate the president, Mr. Barack, I wish I was white, Obama. Go out in a blaze of glory. Barack comes to the state often because it's important to his re-election strategy. And when he comes to the state, he comes to the city, has a rally, talks about hope, talks about change, rah, 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 blah, blah, blah. Brady was figuring out how to avoid metal detectors and random checks when Tones Frobisher buzzed him and told him he had a service call. By the time he was on the road in one of the green Cyber Patrol VWs, he was thinking about something else. Brad Pitt, to be exact. Fucking matinee idol. Sometimes, though, his ideas stick. A chubby little boy comes running down the sidewalk, waving money. Brady pulls over.
I want chocolate, the little boy brays, and I want it with sprinkles.
You got it, you fat-ass little creep, Brady thinks, and smiles his widest, most charming smile. Fuck up your cholesterol all you want. I give you until 40, and who knows, maybe you'll survive the first heart attack. That won't stop you, though, nope. Not when the world is full of beer and whoppers and chocolate ice cream.
You got it, little buddy. One chocolate with sprinkles coming right up. How was school? Get any A's?
15. That night, the TV never goes on at 63 Harper Road, not even for the evening news. Nor does the computer. Hodges hauls out his trusty legal pad instead. Janelle Patterson called him old school. So he is. And he doesn't apologize for it. This is the way he has always worked, the way he's most comfortable. Sitting in beautiful no-TV silence, he reads over the letter Mr. Mercedes sent him. Then he reads the one Mrs. T got. Back and forth he goes for an hour or more, examining the letters line by line. Because Mrs. T's letter is a copy, he feels free to jot in the margins and circle certain words. He finishes this part of his procedure by reading the letters aloud. He uses different voices because Mr. Mercedes has adopted two different personae. The letter Hodges received is gloating and arrogant. Ha ha, you broken down old fool, it says. You have nothing to live for and you know it, so why don't you just kill yourself? The tone of Olivia Trelawney's letter is cringing and melancholy, full of remorse and tales of childhood abuse. But here also is the idea of suicide, this time couched in terms of sympathy.
I understand. I totally get it, because I feel the same.
At last he puts the letters in a folder with Mercedes Killer printed on the tab. There's nothing else in it, which means it's mighty thin. But if he's still any good at his job, it will thicken with page after page of his own notes. He sits for 15 minutes, hands folded on his too large middle like a meditating Buddha. Then he draws the pad to him and begins writing. I think I was right about most of the stylistic red herrings. In Mrs. T's letter, he doesn't use exclamation points, capitalized phrases, or many one-sentence paragraphs. The ones at the end are for dramatic effect. I was wrong about the quotation marks. He likes those. Also fond of underlining things. He may not be young after all. I could have been wrong about that. But he thinks of Jerome, who has already forgotten more about computers and the internet than Hodges himself will ever learn, and of Janie Patterson, who knew how to make a copy of her sister's letter by scanning and who uses Skype. Janie Patterson, who's got to be almost 20 years younger than he is. He picks up his pen again. But I don't think I am. Probably not a teenager, although can't rule it out, but let's say in the range 20 to 35. He's smart, good vocabulary, able to turn a phrase. He goes through the letters yet again and jots down some of those turned phrases. Scurrying little mouse of a kid. Strawberry jam in a sleeping bag. Most people are sheep, and sheep don't eat meat. Nothing that would make people forget Philip Roth, but Hodges thinks such lines show a degree of talent. He finds one more and prints it below the others.
What have they done for you except hound you and cause you sleepless nights?
He taps the tip of his pen above this, creating a constellation of tiny dark blue dots. He thinks most people would write, "Give you sleepless nights," or "Bring you sleepless nights." But those weren't good enough for Mr. Mercedes, because he is a gardener planting seeds of doubt and paranoia.
"They are out to get you, Mrs. T, and they have a point, don't they? Because you did leave your key. The cops say so. I say so, too, and I was there. How can we both be wrong?"
He writes these ideas down, boxes them, then turns to a fresh sheet. "Best point of identification is still perk, for perp. He uses it in both letters, but also note hyphens in the Trelawney letter. Beehive instead of beehive. Weekdays instead of weekdays. If I'm able to ID this guy and get a writing sample, I can nail him." Such stylistic fingerprints wouldn't be enough to convince a jury, but Hodges himself? Absolutely. He sits back again, head tilted, eyes fixed on nothing. He isn't aware of time passing. For Hodges, time, which has hung so heavy since his retirement, has been canceled. Then he lurches forward, off his chair squalling an unheard protest, and writes in large capital letters, "Has Mr. Mercedes been watching?" Hodges feels all but positive he has been, that it's his M.O. He followed Mrs. Trelawney's vilification in the newspapers. He watched her two or three appearances on the TV news. Curt and unflattering, those appearances drove her already low approval ratings into the basement. He may have done drive-bys on her house as well. Hodges should talk to Radney Peoples again and find out if Peoples or any other vigilant employees noted certain cars cruising Mrs. Trelawney's Sugar Heights neighborhood in the weeks before she caught the bus. And someone sprayed "killer cunt" on one of her gateposts. How long before her suicide was that? Maybe Mr. Mercedes did it himself. And of course he could have gotten to know her better, lots better, if she took him up on his invitation to meet under the blue umbrella. "Then there's me," he thinks, and looks at the way his own letter ends.
"I wouldn't want you to start thinking about your gun,"
followed by,
"but you are thinking of it, aren't you?"
Is Mr. Mercedes talking about his theoretical service weapon, or has he seen the .38 Hodges sometimes plays with? No way of telling. But I think he has. He knows where I live. You can look right into my living room from the street, and I think he's seen it. The idea that he's been watched fills Hodges with excitement rather than dread or embarrassment. If he could match some vehicle the vigilant people have noticed with a vehicle spending an inordinate amount of time on Harper Road, that's when the telephone rings.
16.
"Hi, Mr. H.
Sup, Jerome?
I'm under the umbrella." Hodges puts his legal pad aside. The first four pages are now full of disjointed notes, the next three with a close-written case summary, just like in the old days. He rocks back in his chair.
"It didn't eat your computer, I take it?"
"Nope. No worms, no viruses, and I've already got four offers to talk with new friends. One's from Abilene, Texas. She says her name is Bernice, but I can call her Bernie, with an I. She sounds cute as hell, and I won't say I'm not tempted, but she's probably a cross-dressing shoe salesman from Boston who lives with his mother. The internet, dude, it's a wonder box."
Hodges grins.
"First, the background, which I partly got from poking around that self-same internet and mostly from a couple of computer science geeks at the university. You ready?"
Hodges grabs his legal pad again and turns to a fresh page.
"Hit me," which is exactly what he used to say to Pete Huntley when Pete came in with fresh information on a case. "Okay, but first,
Do you know what the most precious internet commodity is?
Nope.
And thinking of Janie Patterson, I'm old school.
Jerome laughs.
That you are, Mr. Hodges. It's part of your charm.
Dryly. Thank you, Jerome.
The most precious commodity is privacy, and that's what Debbie's Blue Umbrella and sites like it deliver. They make Facebook look like a party line back in the 1950s. Hundreds of privacy sites have sprung up since 9/11. That's when the various first world governments really started to get snoopy. The powers that be fear the net, dude, and they're right to fear it. Anyway, most of these EP sites, stands for Extreme Privacy, operate out of Central Europe. They are to internet chat what Switzerland is to bank accounts. You with me?
Yeah.
The Blue Umbrella servers are in Olovo, a Bosnian ville that was mostly known for bullfights until 2005 or so. Encrypted servers. We're talking NASA quality, okay? Traceback's impossible, unless NSA or the Kongsheng, that's the Chinese version of the NSA, have got some super-secret software nobody knows about.
And even if they do, Hodges thinks, they'd never put it to use in a case like the Mercedes killer.
Here's another feature, especially handy in the age of sexting scandals. Mr. H., have you ever found something on the net, like a picture or an article in a newspaper, that you wanted to print and you couldn't?
A few times, yeah. You hit print and the print preview shows nothing but a blank page. It's annoying.
Same thing on Debbie's Blue Umbrella.
Jerome doesn't sound annoyed. He sounds admiring.
I had a little back and forth with my new friend Bernie. You know, how's the weather there? What are your favorite groups? That kind of thing. And when I tried to print our conversation, I got a pair of lips with a finger across them and a message that says, shh, S-H-H-H. Jerome spells this out just to be sure Hodges gets it. You can make a record of the conversation.
You bet, Hodges thinks, looking fondly down at the jotted notes on his legal pad.
But you'd have to take screenshots or something, which is a pain in the ass. You see what I mean about the privacy, right? These guys are serious about it.
Hodges does see. He flips back to the first page of his legal pad and circles one of his earliest notes. Computer savvy? Under 50?
When you click in, you get the usual choice, enter username or register now. Since I didn't have a username, I clicked register now and got one. If you want to talk with me under the Blue Umbrella, I'm Tyrone 40. Next, there's a questionnaire you fill out. Age, sex, interests, things like that. And then you have to punch in your credit card number. It's $30 a month. I did it because I have faith in your powers of reimbursement.
Your faith will be rewarded, my son.
The computer thinks it over for 90 seconds or so. The Blue Umbrella spins and the screen says, sorting. Then you get a list of people with interests similar to yours. You just bang on a few and pretty soon you're chatting up a storm.
Could people use this to exchange porn? I know the descriptor says you can't, but...
You could use it to exchange fantasies, but no pics. Although I could see how weirdos, child abusers, crush freaks, that kind of thing, could use the Blue Umbrella to direct like-minded friends to sites where outlaw images are available.
Hodges starts to ask what crush freaks are, then decides he doesn't want to know. Mostly just innocent chat, then.
Well,
what?
I can see how crazies might use it to exchange badass info, like how to build bombs and stuff.
Let's say I already have a username. What happens then?
Do you?
The excitement is back in Jerome's voice. Let's say I do.
That would depend on whether you just made it up or if you got it from someone who wants to chat with you, like he gave it to you on the phone or in an email.
Hodges grins. Jerome, a true child of his times, has never considered the possibility that information could be conveyed by such a 19th century vehicle as a letter.
Say you got it from someone else, Jerome goes on. Like from the guy who stole that lady's car. Like maybe he wants to talk to you about what he did.
He waits. Hodges says nothing, but he is all admiration.
After a few seconds of silence, Jerome says, "Can't blame a guy for trying. Anyway, you go on and enter the username."
"When do I pay my $30?
"You don't."
"Why not?"
"Because someone's already paid it for you."
Jerome sounds sober now. Dead serious.
probably don't need to tell you to be careful, but I will anyway, because if you already have a username, this guy's waiting for you. 17. Brady stops on his way home to get them supper, subs from Little Chef tonight, but his mother is gorked out on the couch. The TV is showing another of those reality things, a program that pimps a bunch of good-looking young women to a hunky bachelor who looks like he might have the IQ of a floor lamp. Brady sees Ma has already eaten, sort of. On the coffee table is a half-empty bottle of Smirnoff's and two cans of Nutrislim. High tea in hell, he thinks, but at least she's dressed, jeans, and a City College sweatshirt. On the off chance, he unwraps her sandwich and wafts it back and forth beneath her nose, but she only snorts and turns her head away. He decides to eat that one himself and put the other one in his private fridge. When he comes back from the garage, the hunky bachelor is asking one of his potential fuck toys, a blonde, of course, if she likes to cook breakfast. The blonde's simpering reply, "Do you like something hot in the morning?" Holding the plate with his sandwich on it, he regards his mother. He knows it's possible he'll come home some evening and find her dead. He could even help her along. Just pick up one of the throw pillows and settle it over her face. It wouldn't be the first time murder was committed in this house. If he did that, would his life be better or worse? His fear, unarticulated by his conscious mind but swimming around beneath, is that nothing would change. He goes downstairs, voice commanding the lights and computers. He sits in front of number 3 and goes on Debbie's blue umbrella, sure that by now the FedEx cop will have taken the bait. There's nothing. He smacks his fist into his palm, feeling a dull throb at his temples that is a sure harbinger of a headache, a migraine that's apt to keep him awake half the night. Aspirin doesn't touch those headaches when they come. He calls them the little witches, only sometimes the little witches are big. He knows there are pills that are supposed to relieve headaches like that. He's researched them on the net, but you can't get them without a prescription, and Brady is terrified of doctors. What if one of them discovered he was suffering from a brain tumor? A glioblastoma, which Wikipedia says is the worst. What if that's why he killed the people at the job fair? Don't be stupid. A glio would have killed you months ago. Okay, but suppose the doctor said his migraines were a sign of mental illness. Paranoid schizophrenia, something like that. Brady accepts that he is mentally ill. Of course he is. Normal people don't drive into crowds of people or consider taking out the President of the United States in a suicide attack. Normal people don't kill their little brothers. Normal men don't pause outside their mother's doors, wondering if they're naked. But abnormal men don't like other people to know they're abnormal. He shuts off his computer and wanders aimlessly around his control room. He picks up Thing 2, then puts it down again. Even this isn't original, he's discovered. Car thieves have been using gadgets like this for years. He hasn't dared to use it since the last time he used it on Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes, but maybe it's time to bring good old Thing 2 out of retirement. It's amazing what people leave in their cars. Using Thing 2 is a little dangerous, but not very. Not if he's careful. And Brady can be very careful. Fucking ex-cop. Why hasn't he taken the bait? Brady rubs his temples. 18. Hodges hasn't taken the bait because he understands the stakes. Pot limit. If he writes the wrong message, he'll never hear from Mr. Mercedes again. On the other hand, if he does what he's sure Mr. Mercedes expects, coy and clumsy efforts to discover who the guy is, the conniving son of a bitch will run rings around him. The question to be answered before he starts is simple. Who is going to be the fish in this relationship, and who is going to be the fisherman? He has to write something, because the blue umbrella is all he has. He can call on none of his old police resources.
The letters Mr. Mercedes wrote to Olivia Trelawney and Hodges himself are worthless without a suspect. Besides, a letter is just a letter, while computer chat is a dialogue, he says. Only he needs a look.